I'm your host, Blake Collier, and on today's episode of 88 Names Podcast, Matt Ruff and I speak to Michael Maderi, assistant professor in the Department of Philosophy at University of the Pacific. He, along with fellow philosopher Thomas Metzinger, penned the first code of ethical conduct for virtual and augmented realities. In today's interview, we explore the ethics of technology and what it looks like to attempt to prophesy all of the potential negative elements of an industry that is still largely in its infancy. We dig into subjects like avatar ownership, failures at switching between realities, and embodied persuasion via advertisement and other embedded messages. Jumping 30-plus years into the future from the Lynx simulator, we arrive in the 1960s with the first HMD, or head-mounted display, called the Telesphere Mask, which included widescreen viewing and surround sound, and the bulky Sensorama, a 3D-equipped booth that provided sensory information like vibrating seats and smells. Both of these were created by Morten Heilig, a VR pioneer and cinematographer. Heilig was not just a cinematographer or connoisseur of what he termed as the cinema of the future, but was a devoted philosopher of it as well. One can find his writings on VR and film at the University of Southern California's School of Cinematic Arts collection. One such passage does much to explain how he broke down the very nature of virtual reality. All living things engage on a higher or lower level in a continuous cycle of orientation and action. For example, an animal on a mountain ledge hears a rumbling sound and sees an avalanche of rocks descending on it. It cries with terror and makes a mighty leap to another ledge. Here in small is the essence of a process that in animals and man is so automatic, so rapid as to seem one indivisible act. By careful introspection, however, men have been able to stop its rapid flow, bring it into the light of consciousness, and divide it into three basic phases. The first, observation, the noise and image of the boulders in our example, is the reception of isolated impressions or facts. The second, integration, is the combining of these isolated facts with the inner needs of the life force into an emotional unity that prompts and controls action, the animal sensation of danger and terror. The third, action, the leap to safety, is a change in the creature's physical relation to the world. With the forming of society, different men concentrated on one of these three phases, and by learning to cast the results of their labor into concrete forms that could be passed from man to man and generation to generation, they created science, art, and industry. Heilig, understandably, is considered the father of virtual reality, even though his concepts fell by the wayside due to the film industry's inability to profit off the cost of making new 3D films, which required three cameras to be strapped to the cameraman, and providing the height of engagement with smells would have only made the cost of production go up from there. However, it is in these ideas where much of the future innovation and influence in the field would come. Heilig, more than anyone before him, sought to deconstruct human consciousness in order to reconstruct it within a virtual world. Morten Heilig was at the precipice of modern VR and AR technology, and technology would never be the same again.
GC Records proudly sponsors this podcast. To stream or download over 20 years of music, head to gcrecords.bandcamp.com.
So, Michael, so for those who don't know your work, do you mind give us kind of a rundown of who you are and what your focuses are?
Yeah, I'm happy to. My background is in philosophy, but from an interdisciplinary perspective. So I like to bring in themes and results from psychology and neuroscience as well to address questions having to do with the nature of the mind and consciousness. A lot of my work has been on visual perception. That's what my book was on, the first person nature of visual perception, visual consciousness, as well as the ideas about the causal processes, the models in psychology and neuroscience that underlie perception. And that work in that area sort of led me into virtual reality. So I served as a postdoctoral research assistant for a project in Europe, developing new applications for virtual reality with a focus on what we call illusions of embodiment. So giving people the illusion, creating the illusion as if your avatar is your body, that you embody your avatar, even in the cases when your avatar doesn't look like your biological body. As a result of one of the main results of that project was along with Thomas Metzinger, we were the two, so myself and Thomas Metzinger were the two philosophers on this big project. And our job was to evaluate the ethical risks of the technology, both in the research itself and once the technology is made available to the general public. And so in 2016, we published the first code of ethics for immersive technology, where we tried to, and it's an empirically based study where we, you know, we go into the results from psychology, and we just try to raise some of the possible risks that might come up. It was a first try, and you know, we tried to, you know, we covered some of the interesting and then possible areas, and then there are some that we're sure we missed. So what I like to do, let's just say now, is that I'd like to continue the discussion about these issues.
So first off, I want to just get your definition of what virtual reality or immersive technology is. Like, you can speak of it as philosophically, sociologically, you know, however you want to approach it. But what is that? What is virtual reality in your definition?
That's a good question. Nobody's really asked me that question before. I don't have a definition in the sense of, you know, the necessary and sufficient conditions for something to count as immersive technology. I think it's a loose family of technologies. Mm-hmm. I'd say any technology that creates this illusion. We worked with Mel Slater on the project. He's really a pioneer in the area of psychology and immersive tech, and he calls it the place illusion. So if the technology generates this illusion of being in a place other than where you are, then we have a type of immersion. So that tends to be the main illusion that people have in mind, maybe not explicitly, but that people have in mind when we're talking about immersive tech, is that you feel as if you're elsewhere.
Okay.
And that's for virtual reality. Then in augmented reality, you have this kind of blend of, you still feel, you don't have an illusion of being in another place, but you have an illusion of other things being in the place with you that aren't really there. I like to think of virtual reality and augmented reality as being on a kind of continuum, because you can start with just reality and start adding virtual elements to get augmented reality. And then as you add more and more and more, eventually you get to virtual reality. The illusion is generated by what the technical term in psychology that we use is sensory motor contingencies.
Okay.
So what that means is really, it's a fancy way of saying that the way things look to you changes as you move. So the way what you experience visually is contingent upon your motor movements. If you move your head, if you move your body, your visual sensations will change accordingly. So the trick of generating this place illusion in virtual reality is to get that right, is to track movements and then change the visual input in precisely the right way to make you feel as if you are somewhere else.
So jumping into your paper, which is entitled Real Virtuality, A Code of Ethical Conduct. So my first question is, what are the specific challenges to developing ethical standards around technology without being able to understand the fullness of its effects and consequences on society? This is something you bring up in the paper, as you state, is an ethically sound process of precedence setting. And then secondarily, is the foresight so entrenched in past issues of similar technologies that there are categories for new technologies that we just don't have any definitions for or any categories for?
I mean, I think the main challenge is that we seem to be always playing catch up behind the technologies, that the technologies are developed, they're marketed, they're put to use, and it's only after the fact that we realize that there are some risks. And due to the nature of sort of the globalization of the technology industry, it's not as straightforward as sort of a local government or a national government implementing some new regulations or laws. We need to have that's part of the challenge, is how do you regulate something that's with virtual entities and virtual worlds? They really don't have any spatiotemporal location, arguably, in which case it's hard to say who should be in control of them. So there are a number of factors there. The industry is driven by bottom line. They're profit driven, and not typically ethically driven. They're not driven by seeking to make the world a better place, I suspect. Despite what they say sometimes.
Yeah, of course.
so ethics really isn't a priority for the industry and for the governments either. So I think the challenge is sort of having an attitude change in society, where we start to ask ourselves, why are we implementing these new technologies? Are they making us flourish as human beings? Are they increasing our well-being? And in many cases, I think you could say yes, but in many cases, you could also make the argument that they're not. And we're not asking those questions. I think many people just sort of adopt new technology. We celebrate innovation for its own sake. And yeah. I think that's wrong. I think we should say, why are we innovating? And is this going to make life better for human beings? And until we start asking that question, we're going to keep seeing these challenges.
So my first question has to do with your code of conduct. And I was looking at it, and a lot of what you were proposing struck me as both very straightforward and sensible. Like, virtual torture, to the extent that it causes real suffering, is still torture. So if I find somebody who's terrified of heights and I torment them by throwing them off a virtual building, the fact that I'm not, threatening them with death doesn't mean I'm not torturing them. But there were some rules I was hoping you could expand on, just because I wasn't clear on what they meant, or I just thought there were some interesting nuances there. The first one is, avatar ownership will be an important issue for regulatory agencies to consider. There are strong reasons to place restrictions on the way in which avatars can be used, such as protecting the interests and privacy of individuals who strongly identify with their own particular avatar on social networks. Are you talking about impersonation here, or is there more to it than that?
What I'm talking about would be if someone feels strongly identifies with a particular avatar, and then another human was able to animate and control that avatar and have that avatar do things that would be deeply offensive to the person who originally identifies with it.
Okay.
That's the sort of thing I had in mind. There was way back in the, I think it was mid to late 1990s, there was something called a multi-user domain or a multi-user dungeon, where it was like a virtual world, but it was all text-based. And in this world, someone with malicious intent was able to take over the text of particular characters, the narrative, and described what's now called a virtual rape. And the people.
This was the Mr. Bungle case.
The Mr. Bungle case, right? Yeah. So that's sort of what I had in mind, is a Mr. Bungle sort of thing with photorealistic virtual reality.
It wouldn't necessarily mean that people wouldn't necessarily confuse who was doing it. But even so, seeing a version of myself doing awful things, I might not care that, they know that's not me, but still, I don't want to see that.
Exactly. That's what I had in mind, is that you'll have the true belief that's not you, but I suspect that there would be some serious psychological risk of trauma for some people seeing those sorts of things. Yeah.
And it almost becomes a type of branding in its own way if your avatar is so closely knitted to your online persona, or if that's taken over by someone who's using it for bad means, then that would mean that 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 branding would be tarnished on some level.
Yeah, branding, and even I mean, I think we're, who we identify with or how we identify ourselves mm-hmm. is so dynamic. And even beyond branding, I mean, mm-hmm. I think people feel like that, you know, that's me doing that.
Mm-hmm. I think you also run into the problem that people are not always meticulous in distinguishing online between stuff that people really did. And even something that's initially known to be a made up story has a way of taking on legs. And if I don't like somebody, I may come to think of them as having done that awful thing, even though I kind of know that they didn't. You just sort of selectively forget that. And yeah, I can see where that would be an issue. The next one I wanted to ask about is the ability to toggle between virtual reality, augmented reality, and substitutional reality may create situations in which users are not able to maintain an understanding of when their informed consent to share information is in effect. And I gather this mainly applies to research, but I'm just curious exactly what you have in mind there. How am I forgetting that I've given informed consent as I switch these types of reality context?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I should clarify that. So, what I had in mind there is say you're using multiple apps and say in one of the apps you've given informed consent, for them to track your movements in real time, your facial expressions and so on. And then you toggle back to, say, augmented reality. You're talking, you may be having a private conversation with someone, and then you toggle back and forget that when you toggle back into the app where you've given permission, that private conversation may carry over into it, and then you're going to be sharing information that you're not aware of. So I didn't really mean and for research so much as the sort of tracking the data harvesting that goes on now with Silicon Valley. I mean, Google and Facebook are the pioneers in this. So you have Facebook running Oculus, and then Facebook, I strongly suspect they're going to want to Mark Zuckerberg talks about social applications for virtual reality. That's what he's been talking about for years with Oculus. In order to animate your avatar in real time, we can have motion tracking, and that will be very attractive to people. You can, when you smile, your avatar will smile, and when you nod, your avatar will nod. But the worry there is that you're revealing through our bodily movements, we reveal a lot about our psychological states. So we're going to reveal what we're thinking, we're going to reveal our preferences, and that will all be available for harvesting by companies who are interested in this, having this sort of information. So I think the worry is that once the technology, once we become more sort of fluent with and more comfortable with immersive tech, we're not going to keep track of what we're sharing and when we're sharing it. Does that clear it up?
Now I understand it. There's a concept that's maybe the same thing, but I use this in the novel where I talk about context collapse, where, you know, people operating in they've been spending a lot of time in one social or technological environment, and they flip over into another one where the rules of conduct are very different, and they behave in ways that are interpreted differently or that are much more dangerous in that different context than they might be. And, you know, if you forget where you are because you're moving from milieu to milieu, you can commit a social gaffe or something much worse because of that. Yeah. So that's, I think it's the same kind of concept.
It is. Yeah. I mean, I didn't have that exact point in mind, but that is fascinating to think about I guess I was thinking of it more from a privacy perspective, but what you're talking about, I can definitely see that.
Well, I mean, where I see this come up is on Twitter, where people forget they're having a one-to-one conversation on Twitter with someone, and they forget that the world is watching, and they may use slang or terms that the other person understands what they're saying that other people will interpret in bad faith, and you know, it's like, oh, look at this horrible thing this person said. And well, you know, it depends on whose standards are being applied. So it's, this is the sort of thing that comes up a lot. And It's why I personally try to always remember where I am and how likely things are to be taken out of context. It's a yeah. So the last thing I wanted to ask about on this was you have one that says users ought to be made aware that there is evidence that advertising tactics using embodiment technology such as VR can have a powerful unconscious influence on behavior. For example, a combination of big nudging strategies with VR technology could have long-lasting effects, which might also affect underlying mental mechanisms themselves. So what are big nudging strategies and how could VR enhance them?
Yeah, so the big nudging was a concept that my co-author, that Thomas, introduced. And it's funny because I had to ask him the same question. What do you mean by that? And what he meant by that is he meant to combine big data with the concept of nudging. I don't know if you're familiar with nudging. You'll see it in political philosophy sometimes. Cass Sunstein has written on this. And the idea there is the question of whether or not governments should make decisions that sort of promote the sort of behavior that they would like to promote. And the example that's commonly used. Should I go into it? Are you familiar with it?
Go ahead.
But go ahead, because some of the listeners may not.
Yeah, one example that's commonly used is organ donation. So should governments have it set up that you have to opt in to organ donation or opt out? And they found that, if I remember right, if you make people opt out, they're much more likely to participate in organ donation. Is that ethical? So by structuring our environment, so it's well known that the way in which we structure our environment can change behavior in subtle ways and perhaps not so subtle ways sometimes. And the idea there is that once we have people spending significant amounts of time in a virtual world, we can really have enhanced nudging and precise nudging based on big data. So we can know exactly when we want to make a small change in the virtual environment in order to maximize the likelihood of a user deciding to do one thing or another, if you see what I mean. Mm-hmm. So the concern there is that we'll have behavioral manipulation, but we'll have it on a much more powerful scale than we're familiar with now. I mean, if we can have behavioral manipulation, by changing the physical environment, even a sidewalk, for example, would be, that's where we're going to walk. If you build a sidewalk, and that's nothing to worry about, of course. But once we were able to change the digital environments, so quickly, so much more quickly than you can change the physical environment, then I think the possibilities for nudging become really, really concerning.
Okay, I get it.
Yeah, that's quite good. So my next question is: so if I'm not mistaken, the paper came out in 2016. Have you shifted your general thesis around ethical use of VR since then? And have there been any real world scenarios that have made you question some of your guidelines and assertions?
Yeah. Let's see. Two different questions. I'll take the second question first.
Sounds good.
That's okay.
That's great.
There are two things. So we only put one or two lines in the original paper about guidelines for children.
And
I think that deserves much more attention. So that's something. I mean, that could be an entire study on its own. Because there's a problem with a dilemma with research ethics is that you want to figure out how the technology might be risky for some of your most vulnerable users. So for children and for individuals with latent mental illness, for example. But on the other hand, you can't ethically do experiments on them that put them at risk using technology, if you see what I mean. Mm-hmm. So it's really difficult to get empirical results that you can use to make these decisions. What are the age guidelines for the usage of immersive technology? And we have now we have companies that are slapping age guidelines on their products, but if but to my knowledge, it's not based on any sort of empirical work. If it is, they're not publishing it. So, so that's a real concern. That's something I think we should have emphasized a bit more. The second thing is, so I think this was maybe in 2017 or 2018, there was a case of sexual harassment in a virtual world. I don't know if you saw this, but there was a female player. I think she was playing an archery game, and she switched into multiplayer mode through the internet and was using the microphone. And then some male players heard that she was female. I guess that was unusual to encounter a female player, and went over and violated her personal space, started putting his avatar's hands where he shouldn't. Mm-hmm. And she said that, you know, she reported that she felt as if she were sexually assaulted. And many people online made fun of her and ridiculed her and said she was just looking for attention. But, you know, if you look at some of the results that we cite in the Code of Ethics, it's extremely plausible that she really felt that way, because when you're immersed, you really feel as if you are embodied in your avatar.
Sure.
Right. So that was a mistake. It was an oversight. We should have included the possibility of sexual assault in the virtual world. And sure enough, it happened. But I have to congratulate the company, the video game, I forget the creators, but they quickly put in what they call a power move in the game, where you can move your hand in such a way that would clear your personal space of anyone else. Okay. But that's the sort of thing, you know, it's hard to sort of anticipate these things. And that's one that we missed. Lately, I've been sort of broadening my scope beyond immersive technology, just sort of to human computer interface in general. I've been thinking a lot about the issue of human agency, which sort of touches on what we were talking about a minute ago with nudging. So I'm really worried about the idea that as we're spending more and more time in front of screens and using software that we have not designed ourselves and that we're not always sure what the intention of designers are, I'm really concerned that there may be cases in which the human computer interface is causing us to behave in ways that aren't always aligned with our own intentions. So a kind of undermining of our human autonomy by technology. Mm-hmm. I'm really not prepared to go into all the details now, but that just gives you an idea about what I've been thinking about since this article was published.
So you would almost say it's a broadening of some of the same ideas that were put in the paper, just in a more general computer human interface or interaction.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I started to realize that some of the worries that I raised in the article, that we raised in the article, are worries that you don't always need immersive technology to have those worries come up. Mm-hmm. I think that we're being nudged in ways that even without being fully immersed, as long as we're sitting in front of the screen, the way that the apps are designed, I think, you know, they're designed to get our attention. Yeah. And to keep our attention, and that's not in the service of our autonomy. I was really influenced by, I don't know if you know it, but The Age of Surveillance Capitalism.
Oh, I've heard of the I've heard the title.
Yeah, yeah. So I've really started thinking about the future direction. You know, where is technology leading us? What can we anticipate for the way in which human behavior could be changed? I mean, her thesis is that, you know, the Silicon Valley is in the business of manipulating and predicting behavior, and that's a frightening thesis. And that's something I think I'd like to think more about and sort of identify ways of preserving and recovering human autonomy in the digital age.
Yeah, you talked about that continuum between you know, augmented reality and virtual reality, and that kind of what I thought of reading, you know, some of the things you're concerned about in the paper, that yeah, a lot of this, even though we don't have the fully realized VR that people dream of yet, even the technologies that aren't necessarily thought of as VR, the computer-based social media, has got a lot of the same issues in a more larval form, maybe. So it makes sense that you'd already start seeing some of that stuff.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's kind of precisely what happened with my thinking. And yeah, I'm glad that you mentioned that. Yeah.
Derooted is a proud sponsor of the 88 Names podcast. Derooted, immersive experiences and interactive activations helping brands connect globally. Find case studies and more at derooted.com.
One of the recurring themes in my novel is the practical difficulty of getting people to obey rules when they have, you know, different goals and values than the rules makers. And this comes up a lot in game design. You know, for example, in online role-playing games like World of Warcraft, they often enable player versus player combat as one of the things you can do, which can be a lot of fun, but inevitably you have people who will repurpose that as a tool for harassment. So instead of seeking out fair fights with people who are in the mood to have a fight, they will target players who are doing something else, or, you know, specifically seek unfair fights with weaker players just to ruin their fun. And particularly when talking about computer games, it's easy to make this naive assumption that because programmers have a sort of godlike ability to sort of set the rules of physics of the game world and decide what literally is and isn't possible, that laying down the law ought to be a simple matter. But that's when you discover how people who are in the mood to, you know, perform degenerate behaviors can be very, very resourceful in finding loopholes and ways to keep doing what they want to do, even as you try to stop them. And that problem is, I think, only magnified when you get out in the real world, where regulators and legislators often have far less power. I mean, they may have, you know, blunter tools like putting people into prison, but in other ways, they don't have nearly as much control over behavior. So what I was wondering is, in the field of ethics, is this problem of rules compliance something that you spend time on? Is it part of what you do, or is your role more to, like, let's think about what the rules ideally ought to be or what things people should be concerned of, and let somebody else worry about the practical nuts and bolts of enforcement and compliance?
There are more theoretical areas of ethics where we would just say, what should the rules be? And then there are areas of applied ethics where we have some overlap. It sounds like a lot of what you're talking about would be overlap with political philosophy, you know, and sort of what sort of mechanisms are permissible for the regime to use to enforce its rules, and what sort of mechanisms are ideal for the regime to use. So yeah, I mean, I think we definitely ask questions like that, and it does raise this kind of fascinating question, though, where we might ask, when you go into a virtual world, are you bound by the same rules? Whether it's a game or just a neutral space, what are the ethical obligations for a user when you're in a world such as World of Warcraft? For example, if you're, you know, there's this idea that if you're playing a game, if you're playing a sport, and through the course of play, you kill someone, you know, you're not, typically we say, well, you're not morally responsible for that because it was a game. It's not murder. So there is this kind of hazy or peculiar shift in ethical obligations when we go into a play space, a game-like space. But now But the strange thing is, though, is that something like World of Warcraft, it need not be a purely play space. It could be also a social place, right? There's
it definitely is. Right.
It is, right? Yeah. You probably know the case where there was a player died in real life, and there was a funeral procession for him. His guild had a funeral procession for him in the game, which was a social gathering. And then a competing guild went and raided them during they found out
about
it.
Yeah, I don't know the specific story, but I saw that punchline coming. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I mean, what I was sort of getting at, though, I mean, it's, yeah, not so much I was thinking more of the practical aspects of, again, it's like, yes, you can definitely say that there's an ethical obligation not to do something, but there's still the question of having said that this is the rule we think people should follow, how do we get them to actually do that if they have the freedom to say, well, I don't have the same value set that you do, or I'm not playing the same game that you are, is the one way to put it. And I just wondered if that is a thing that ethics, because in your paper you do it sometimes talk about, you know, we don't think that this is a practical thing that can be done, and but other times you're just like, this is something regulators should be concerned with, without really getting into the nuts and bolts of how they would solve the problem. So I was just curious how much that practical difficulty of getting people to comply. That's why I'm saying compliance rather than enforcement, because force isn't necessarily the best way in a lot of cases. My own sense is that often the easiest way to get people to behave in a certain way is to point out why it's in their own best interest for them to do that, and have them basically choose to play by the rules rather than try and say, I know you don't want to do it, but you're going to.
Right. Yes. I see your question. That really isn't a topic that I've really given a lot of thought to.
So that's not necessarily part of ethics then, or not a big part of it.
I would, like I said, I would put that over in the domain of political philosophy.
Okay.
Which really isn't, it's not really my area of expertise. There are these questions of, you know, nudging. It sort of gets back to the nudging issue. That would be one way to do it without force. And then, you know, the question then is that permissible? Someone with, say, libertarian leanings would say, you know, no, that you know, institutions and governments should not be in the business of shaping your behavior and of nudging you to choose in various ways. And others, of course, would argue against that. So, yeah, I guess that's really the only thing that comes to mind. Would you want to say a bit more about how it plays out in the book to maybe give me an idea? Or,
well, no, I mean in the book I'm generally, I guess the sort of libertarian mindset would probably be closer to it, but more just the idea of my sort of fascination is interactions between people with different worldviews who do not necessarily share the same values. Basically figuring out how to, like, one of the constant refrains in the novel is the protagonist is saying, you know, it doesn't matter what I think about this. What matters is what the other guy thinks. Because if you're trying to understand somebody's behavior or get them to behave in a certain way, it really doesn't matter what you want. What matters is what values they respond to, what their goals are. And so I guess, yeah, so you could say my character is my protagonist is more of a nudger, just mm-hmm. not necessarily for ethical reasons, like this is moral, but that's what's going to work. I don't have the power to force you to do what I want, but I can find an incentive that will get you to. He's thinking, I guess, not so much like a libertarian as he's an entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. He's a salesperson, and the other folks are customers. And how do I get the customer to buy what I want them to buy? How do I get them to do what I want them to do? So it's somewhat of a manipulative strategy, but it's also pragmatic.
Yeah.
In the sense of, you know, it doesn't do me any good to get mad. I need to find out what will work.
I see. And how does, so I mean, what you're describing seems to me is sort of a universal human problem to address. How does the, if I may ask, how does the technology add a different angle to this?
Basically, it creates a realm. Like the main character is a gold farmer. And so he's someone who makes money by violating the terms of servants of the game worlds in which he operates. And the reason the book is called 88 Names, one of the reasons is that part of the cost of doing business is he periodically gets caught violating the terms of service and his accounts get banned, but he's got multiple accounts. So he keeps coming back. And as long as he can make enough money doing what he does to sort of cover the cost of losing these accounts, it's like breakage. It's just part of the cost of doing business. So he's operating in the gray market, and then the virtual world sort of create a realm where people from all over the world and people with very different value sets and goals can, you know, get forced to interact with one another. I mean, that's again, that part of what fascinated me about the idea of role-playing games specifically, or sandbox virtual reality games where you there are ostensible quests and goals, but really you decide yourself what kind of game you want to play. Do I want to be social with my friends? Do I want to just, you know, indulge my obsessive compulsive desire to acquire virtual loot? Do I want to do something else? And that kind of fascinated me, the idea of the interaction with between people with very different, playing different games in the same space, and how you navigate that. And then adding on top of that, the fact that you can masquerade, you never really know who you're dealing with, because in virtual reality, people do have this godlike control over how they appear, how they sound. The book is set far enough in the future that, you know, voice synthesizers are a built-in part of the technology. So, for example, that woman who was being molested in the Archer game, in this advanced VR, you don't have to sound like a woman unless you want to. You don't have to speak English if you don't want to. You can try to pass yourself off as a native speaker of a language you've never studied. And that, all of that together, and then trying to sort of interact and learn how to play together. That's sort of my broad thesis of it, what the book is about.
Yeah, you'd almost say that the one aspect of your book would be where capitalism and anonymity meet.
Yeah, that's so, a good way to put it, or at least pseudonymity. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Never as anonymous as they think they are, especially in technological environments.
Someone knows.
So when we're not in cyberspace, we can have some presuppositions about the value systems and people we'll run into, because
it's probably easier to predict, I think, and because it's harder to fool people in face-to-face interactions. It certainly happens, but one of the things that technology does, it just enables this pseudonymous behavior where it's easier to pass yourself off as something you're not. And again, there's a sense where people who would never do that in real life because they consider it an ethical violation, there's something about the virtual reality that sort of loosens and, well, I'm just playing around here, it doesn't count. I think that's, you know, again, it there's that context shift of the online, it kind of enables behaviors that you might balk at in reality.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. That sounds fascinating. I'm sort of thinking about how in technology ethics, people talk about the balkanization of online culture, where we seek out these small groups of people who agree with us, and then sort of confirm, you know, we confirm our own, what we already believe, by seeking out people who agree with us. But I guess what you're describing is a mechanism where there's a motivation to seek out, or a financial motivation to seek out people outside of one's group. And then that's when this problem arises, it seems.
And I mean, part of this is just a reflection of my own interest as a person and an artist, that I'm fascinated by people whose worldviews are different from my own. And in interactions, you know, culture clashes where people are forced to interact and they can't just do the thing that people like to do online, where they like to balkanize. I'm just going to go hang out with people who think like me. And
right.
I get the attraction of that, but it's sort of interesting, both dramatically and intellectually, for me to create situations where that's not an option. Like, no, I've got to stay in the car with this person I can't stand, and we've got to figure out a way to live together. And that to me is just interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I see that. Yeah, that's great. That's great. That's fascinating.
So I'm going to change. I'm going to vary my next question a little bit. So the way I see a lot of elements of especially political discourse in this day and age is basically two sides of an issue talking past each other, in a sense that, for instance, issues of racism. You have the African-American community who is speaking in more collective terms as a people, and you have the white community who are often myopic in how they view their own entity within an individual setting. You know, I'm not to blame. I did not do those things. And so I think my question for you is when you're looking at ethical guidelines for VR technology, or really any of your focuses, how often do you have to transfer between individual terms and collective terms or systemic terms as some might call it.
If I understand you right, I mean that's sort of a constant challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, we like, you know, in academics, we like to think that we're trained very carefully in critical thinking to identify, I would like to think that I wouldn't try to make a claim or put an argument out there without objective rational justification for it.
But we
shouldn't kid ourselves. We're not perfectly rational thinkers. So I'm sure that my individual preferences and prejudices do creep into the claims that I make. And the challenge is to sort of identify when that happens and fix it when it happens. And that's sort of the ideal of the university, right? The academic life is that we're supposed to, in an unbiased way, we're supposed to engage with one another and calmly discuss, you know, think through these issues and point out to one another when we think we've gone off the path or when we've introduced some bias. But realistically, I think we all have to acknowledge that there's always a risk of that. Did that answer your question?
It's a very abstract question. And when I was reading it to prepare to ask you, I was like, I'm not sure that there's enough there to really give you something to bite into. And so I tried to reword it. I think in some ways I am fascinated by this meeting of two different positions, like we've been talking about before, is how do we, when we meet someone who has different value systems and different belief systems, how do we then find not necessarily common ground, because I don't always think that's necessarily the case, but find a place where we can meet and we can, like you say, calmly discuss these things in a beneficial and efficient way, and begin to start seeing that transfer of positions and start seeing the other person's ideas or how they view themselves within this bigger idea. What is your process? And do you start out with the individual and kind of broaden it to more of a collective, or do you go the other way? Or is it kind of just a mix of depending on, you know, what topic you're looking at?
I mean, there was a challenge in I wrote this and I was a co-author with Thomas Metzinger, and he and I mean, we haven't really talked about it, but we're not going to assume, or I can't go into this assuming that my co-author or the people, my audience, is going to share my own general approach to ethics. So in Western moral philosophy, there are typically three general approaches that can be identified. One is consequentialism, also known as utilitarianism, where you evaluate the moral value of an action by the outcome. So even if you have to do something like murder someone, there's maybe cases where it's permissible if it brings about the greater happiness in the long run, or if it minimizes suffering in the long run. Mm-hmm. Another approach is associated with Immanuel Kant, where he focuses on the nature of the actions themselves. He says, ask yourself, the action that you're about to do, would you want to live in a world where everyone gave themselves permission to perform that action? So you focus more on the action itself. And the final approach is traced back to Aristotle, and that's known as virtue ethics, where the focus is on living, asking what is a virtuous life, and how might we cultivate the virtues. And also go back to Aristotle and asking, I think this is one strategy for finding common ground, is then to say, we don't have to go into the details of the virtues, but we can just ask more generally a question that I think you can find in Aristotle is, what is the good life for human beings? What is human flourishing? And that's not a question that we really ask as a society, I think, very much. But it is, as far as I can tell, it should not be a controversial question, right? It's a question that really invites common ground and invites agreement among people with different value systems. Maybe I'm being too idealistic about it, but I think that's sort of where I put my hope. I think that When we do have different value systems, we can at least agree that there are, we can at least discuss the possibility that there's such a thing as a good life for human beings and they're flourishing for human beings. And I mean, some moral philosophers have even suggested that we think about it. You know, they say, look, you can get two people with two different value systems to look at a plant and say whether or not it's flourishing, right? Mm-hmm. Is this a healthy plant, right? Is this doing well as a plant? And the idea is you transfer that question back to the human being, right. Not in an objectifying way, but you say, you know, is this a case of thriving for the human species? And of course, there will be disagreement once we start talking about more details about how to answer that question. But I like to think it's a good start.
Yeah. No, and I would think that that question itself would at least give some semblance of active search for well-being for someone who is completely different from you, at least in theory. That isn't always the case in practice, but but it would seem like if everyone had that question at the very heart of their actions in this society, then that would be an active pursuit of the best for their neighbor or whoever it may be.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
The one more thing I wanted to ask. So new technologies present new ethical and moral challenges, but they also create new opportunities for moral panic. And I find, especially as I get older, when I see some scare story or news story about people worrying about something, I often find that I recognize it as sometimes it's an urban legend that's been, you know, found new life, like, oh, this is the new version of, you know, D&D will turn your children into Satanists. And sometimes it's a valid concern, but it's one that is not as novel as might first appear. An example might be internet addiction, where that is a real thing, but addiction more generally is something that has been with the human race forever. And it's like we at least have some understanding of it. It's not like we have to start from zero. And there are also, of course, threats that are truly unprecedented, but because that's kind of such a sexy concept, they're rare. And I think people in some ways want them to exist more commonly than they do, because there's something cool about discovering this new unique threat. And I was wondering in, you know, how do you strike this balance and distinguish between, you know, technological hazards that are truly unprecedented, threats that represent new variations on old problems, and then, you know, seemingly valid concerns that really are just overreactions to change?
Yeah. Like, yeah. That's a great question. That's probably one of the biggest challenges of working in the field that I work in. Yeah. That's really, really difficult. I tell people I was given this task of evaluating the ethical risks of virtual reality. So it's sort of in my interest to say, you know, there are all these really serious risks of virtual reality. And it's, you know, I deliberately made an effort, you know, to not overstate my case. I think that would have been, counterproductive, I think, you know, to sort of overstate the risks. So my strategy for trying to avoid that, as I said in the beginning of our conversation, to be very careful about having my claims based on empirical work. If the evidence is there from psychology, there's not much room for hysteria. You just sort of say, here are the facts, and this is why we're concerned about it. Yeah, that's the strategy that I use. I hope it's effective. You know, I just have to be continually self-critical. But I guess the larger question you're asking, yeah, I mean, I think you've really hit on something that's sort of the professional challenge the people working in my field run into is, and just look in the last 10 years how quickly the technology has changed, and with the, you know, how much social media has changed our lives.
Yeah.
We're going through something as a species, as an entire species. We're going through something really weird that we've never run into before. So on one hand, you know, you can shrug and say, well, it's just the next thing, no big deal. On the other hand, you can freak out about it. And the trick is finding the middle, you know, finding the right or the appropriate reaction, right?
I would just add, I have a lot of respect for, you know, the difficulty that scientists have, because in some ways my job is so much easier, where there's a way in which fiction is really the opposite of science, where I get you to people to suspend their disbelief, and I just got to tell a good story. It doesn't matter whether it's true. And you guys actually have to worry about, well, this sounds good, but can we prove it? And, or can't we? And yeah, so I actually have a lot of respect for the discipline it takes to do that right.
Well, same thing for me. I would find it incredibly difficult to write fiction. So the respect goes in both directions.
And I'm probably somewhere in between you two. I write nonfiction, and I would find both of y'all's jobs very difficult. So yeah. So the final question I have for you is, and this is actually one of the reasons why I wanted to interview you, is like, because I think this is perhaps one of the elements of this specific technology that is perhaps potentially worrying, the most worrying for me, is you speak about in the paper this idea of dual use of this technology by governments, prisons, militaries, and other bad actors. Are there spaces where these concerns are already fully realized in the last 4 years? And if not, where do you see the first transgression of these ethical standards taking place?
If there has been a transgression, I don't know about it.
Okay.
So there are, I mean, there's work being done for rehabilitation of prisoners using virtual reality. And I have a lot of hope in that. I think that's great work, but that's the kind of area where we have to be very careful.
Yes.
That we may abuse it, right? That it we'll have to make sure that the applications are for rehabilitation and not for punishment. Mm-hmm. And to be clear, I'm not aware of anything like that going on. But if we're talking about undesirable scenarios, that would be one.
Could you be a bit more detailed about what they're doing? I mean, how does that work, rehabilitation with VR?
Yes, it's fantastic work. It was one of the results of our project out of Mel Slater's lab, where he's taking men, this was in Spain, men who were domestic abusers. They're violent towards their partners. And they took these guys and then put them into a female avatar in virtual reality. And they had a full illusion of embodiment of being in a female body. They look in the mirror and see themselves, they're female. And then they have an actor come in, a male actor come in the virtual world and verbally abuse them and physically intimidate them. So it put them in their victim's shoes, so to speak. Mm. And it was, I saw footage of the results, and it's really impressive work, really impressive work. And it's being implemented in I don't know the status of it now, but I think it's being implemented in the penal systems there, to some extent. It's still experimental, and that's why, you know, and that's why they wanted to have ethicists on the project. That's why Thomas and I were one of the reasons why we were part of this, is that this is risky. This is risky territory, and it's effective. I'm not saying anything bad at all about the work. I think it's fantastic work. But you know, if someone were to claim that they're in the business of rehabilitation and then twist it up a little bit into a case of punishment or revenge, then we can have, you know, then we'll see abuse of the technology.
So the idea is these guys were volunteers, rather than you. It's not like the court can sentence you to go through this, and that would obviously be something that would start crossing the line, maybe.
Right. That's the right. These guys, they were volunteers, and it was done in conjunction with therapy, and so on. So, you know, it's really top notch work. But right, you can imagine a scenario where it's mandatory, kind of a Clockwork Orange sort of scenario. Mm-hmm. You know, that's something we have to be really vigilant about. In addition to that, I think indoctrination is probably the biggest thing I'm worried about, because, you know, I mean, virtual torture, we'll be able to see that when it's happening and identify pretty clearly as something that's problematic, I would hope. But with indoctrination, it's going to be more subtle, right? It's going to be situations where you have users, perhaps young users, in a virtual world, and that virtual world may be designed to change their belief system. Okay. In subtle ways, and then perhaps in not so subtle ways, and then the the young users and their parents won't even realize what's going on, until we have a real substantial psychological change in the individuals, and at which point it may be difficult to sort of give them their autonomy back once they've been fully indoctrinated.
Oh yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. So that's all the questions we have. We do want to give you a chance to give us any kind of update on future works coming out or what you're busy doing here currently.
Oh, yeah. Right now, I mentioned it earlier. Right now, I'm working on a paper on the idea of the illusion of agency in human-computer interaction. So there are some results. Daniel Wegner did a lot in psychology, did some work in the 1990s where he was able to trick people into feeling as if they performed actions that they really didn't.
Okay.
And he was kind of inspired by purported paranormal phenomena in the 19th century, like table turning and the Ouija board and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Where he says, from a naturalistic scientific perspective, these people are performing these actions, but they lose their sense of agency for them. They don't feel as if they're performing their actions. They feel as if, spirit or whatever is performing the actions. So there's plenty of evidence from psychology that our sense of agency can go wrong, that it can misfire and distort. In the psychiatric literature, you see it all the time in schizophrenia, for example, where we perform actions that we don't feel are under our control. And we suffer from these illusions of agency. So what I'm exploring is that is it possible that we experience illusions of agency when we're interacting with our devices?
Yeah.
Especially when we go, you see someone going on their phone sort of mindlessly as a habit without any intention, just checking in online and so on. I'm trying to make the case that what's going on there is that we're really just responding to stimuli in an automatic way, and it's not intentional action. It really shouldn't. There are many cases where it's not authentic intentional action, which is, of course, is problematic if you're concerned about autonomy.
That is it for this episode of 88 Names Podcast. We will be back next Friday with a new episode. If you like the podcast, go to Apple Podcasts and give us a rating and a review, which will help us get more listeners. Remember to check back at the podcast site at riseupdaily.com/88namespodcast for the podcast introduction and upcoming written interviews and articles. We would like to thank Threaded Zebra Agency, AltSpace VR, Drooted, and Creative Mornings for their support and work on this podcast. We will see you soon.